Hello, and welcome to Breast Cancer Conversations, a podcast brought to you by survivingbreastcancer.org. I'm Laura Carfing, breast cancer survivor and founder of survivingbreastcancer.org, a nonprofit organization providing community, education, and resources to empower those diagnosed with breast cancer and their caregivers from day one and beyond. Hello, hello, my friends, and welcome back to another episode of Breast Cancer Conversations. I am so glad you are here to tune in to this very important topic that we want to shine light on. That is breast cancer and domestic violence. A lot of times we talk about how breast cancer can impact our relationships. And today we are joined with Lourdes and Cami, who are going to give personal examples and share scenarios of warning signs to know if we are not in a healthy relationship. Some of the topics in today's discussion may be triggering, so I want to make sure that if you need to take a breath, a pause, take a step back, that is completely okay. This is a very heavy topic, but one that is very important, and we want to empower you with resources and tools to notice if this affects you or anyone in your circle. Welcome to the conversation.
Hello, everyone. My name is Lourdes Heras, and I'm actually joining from Arizona. And I have lived here for quite a few years, and just wanted to invite and have someone to touch on this subject. I think in our, especially in the Hispanic community, we don't talk about certain things because we find them embarrassing or because sometimes we put that blame on ourselves for something that is really not our fault or it has nothing to do with what we did or what we have done. So just want to shed some light on perhaps providing those resources to our community, especially after a diagnosis of breast cancer. I always say, as if cancer was not enough, having to deal with a health issue and a violent intimate partner is not easy. And I will probably share some experiences of what I experienced during this time. And I just wanted to make sure that we shed some light on that topic. So
thank you, Lourdes, and thank you for being so open and vulnerable and honest about your experience as well, because I know you're helping so many of our viewers and listeners. Cami, it's great to have you here today as well, and thank you for taking the time to share your expertise and resources with our community. If you'd like to introduce yourself and where you're calling from.
Sure. My name is Cami Infrasato, and I am the Women's Program Coordinator for the Domestic Abuse Intervention Programs. I am also a victim survivor of domestic violence. I've been doing this work for over a decade, and I'm continually working on bringing new programs to the community and work hands-on with the women couple times a week, and also have them incorporate their ideas into what they want into the programming, which is a little different than what some other programs do. And I think that's important to the women in keeping their interest and in keeping them engaged and really bringing them what they need in the program, or bringing to them what they need.
Yeah, you know, it's such a hard topic to discuss and talk about. And so I don't have personal experience with domestic violence per se, but on the breast cancer side, I do, being a someone who was diagnosed with breast cancer under 40. I was in my 30s. And, you know, that decision, and Lourdes and I talk about this a lot, to disclose this information, to disclose a cancer diagnosis or a health issue to family members or friends, let alone the public, can be incredibly daunting and is so much a personal choice. And a lot of times too, it's not necessarily a visible thing, right? If you're not going through chemotherapy, you still have your hair, you still might be working. It might not be externally visible that you are a cancer patient or going through active treatment. And so it can be very private, depending on, you know, even if you do lose your hair, you might wear a wig, you might not tell a lot of people. Now, is domestic violence also one of those things that, you know, it's not obvious necessarily to the person, to the victim, or to their peer groups or their coworkers, et cetera? Do I have that correct? Is that a parallel that we can draw?
I would say yes, in some ways, of course, because a lot of times it's embarrassment, not wanting to disclose that that's happening to you for whatever reason. And or fear of if that person finds out, what are they going to do? further damage or anything like that. But I think that perhaps that might be something that it is true for some people, not for everybody. But perhaps Cami can provide some information, some statistics, the focus on the whole statistics of domestic violence in general, too.
Sure. On average right now, what we're coming up with for statistics through the National Statistics on Domestic Violence fact sheets is that there on average is nearly 20 people per minute that are physically abused by an intimate partner. One in four of those women experience severe intimate partner violence. And some of that, it has to do with sexual contact. Sorry about that. And let's see, there was another fact that I had wanted to bring up. On a typical day, there are more than 20,000 phone calls placed to domestic violence shelters nationwide. And the presence of guns in a domestic violence situation increases the risk of homicide by 500%. And there was one, stalking is a part of it. 19.3 million women and 5.1 million men in the United States have been stalked in their lifetime. But the impact is great in the fact that it isn't just being hit, as we know, and it isn't just the verbal violence. There's economic abuse, there's physical and mental impact, and then there's parts where the children are impacted. And there are some of those statistics that we have, but nothing that I can be specific about because it actually isn't on that website. But one of the wheels that I had worked on and was published in 2014 had to do with the violence that impacted children. And it's usually like post-separation. And it's a wheel that was written in addition to or supplemental to the power and control wheel, which explains the tactics of domestic violence. And it's put together in such a way that the outside of the wheel is what is the violence that holds the tactics together, which are each in spokes of the wheel, and the center is the actual power and control. And what's interesting about the wheel is that it was put together by women who had experienced domestic violence. And over 200 women had been interviewed to put this wheel together. And that happened in 1984. And people will ask me, will the wheel ever get old? I don't believe that it will ever get old. And I also believe that before the women put the wheel together, that these tactics of power and control have existed for a very long time. So again, if anybody ever asks me, will the power and control ever be old, or the power and control wheel ever get old? I don't believe that it will. I don't want to think or believe really that domestic violence is going to carry on into the future in the way that it is. I hope that women find some sense of peace and relief from what they experience with domestic violence. But going forward, these tactics will ooze out in one way or squeeze out in one way or another. And that's why it's important to have this model to look at, because it's beneficial for women, and women should get it the first time that they encounter someone who is in the helping field. And oftentimes they don't get that until much later. I think if they were to receive this wheel earlier on, that they would be able to have more of an awareness of what's happening in their lives.
I absolutely agree with that, Cami. Laura, if I may add too, I didn't know or knew about this power and control wheel until my judge gave it to me at my order of protection site hearing. And at that point in time, these words, I keep hearing these words where he turns to my lawyer and says, I want you to walk Lourdes to her car. Do not lose sight of her until she gets in her car. She hands me that power of control wheel. And that's the first time I have ever seen that power and control wheel. And that's the first time I realized, holy cow, like, this is serious. And they are making me aware of that this person could easily hurt me in very many ways. So I am really thankful that the judge provided me with that handout, but also with the words that she said. I think those were really powerful, and it kind of shocked me at that point in time where I was like, wow, I didn't know it was that serious. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and for some women, it's become their normal. And until they see that it's not normal, and it sometimes takes being pointed out by someone like a judge or someone else in their life and through the wheel, and then knowing too that it's based on the experience of other women, and that it's not going to get old, and that these are the tactics.
Yeah. And I don't know if we are able to put it on the screen, but I know that from my personal experience, every single item on the wheel, I definitely, now that I can see it from a little bit of an outside perspective, stepping back, is like awakening of, holy cow, I did go through each one of these phases, I would say, from the control and the power that person placed on me, and then how they cause others. I was talking to Cami last night about how even the lies that they tell people, how they involve people to believe them of their lies. I remember the church turned their back on me because they believe a lot of the lies that he was saying. And it was very disappointing that when I needed someone the most, like, all these doors were shutting down in a way because of this person and the lies that they were saying, from the lies that they were involving even their children with, and having that, you know, affecting my daily life. So yeah, there was every single face that I can see and hear, and the way that person, yeah, had a power and control.
I would love to just walk through. This is such a helpful framework. And I know for those watching the video, they can see the visual, but for our listeners too, Cami, maybe we can go through the framework and some of these elements. And then I would love to follow up then with Lourdes on your personal experience and kind of those eye-opening moments you were touching upon. So, you know, right in the middle, it's almost like a bicycle spoke, right? Like a wheel where you have like the power on the middle, and then these brackets kind of springing out afterwards, like the spokes of the wheel. So using coercion and threats, using intimidation, emotional abuse, using isolation, minimizing, denying, and blaming, getting the children involved, using the children, using male privilege as a tactic, and using economic abuse. And so these are the data points that you were describing from that study of those 200 women. And you know, I think they're so unfortunately universal. I agree that they're not going to get old.
No. And it can be applied in other ways too. So there's even a wheel that I'm not sure if it's been published or not yet. I haven't looked if it's on our website, but there's a wheel for women who are in politics, and these tactics will apply. They change. Some things may change or they may adapt, but basically the tactics are the same. So in what had happened in 1984 is they took groups of women and they talked to them about their experience, their lived experience, what happened in their relationships. And that's how the tactics came to result in this wheel. And so oftentimes the women, you'll hear one of the first things that women start to talk about and they recognize about their experience is the put downs. I mean, aside from any physical abuse, they know those things. They know about the put downs. They recognize that that's a tactic. But it's interesting, as you go through the wheel, oftentimes one of the last things for women to recognize is the economic abuse. And when women are in a support group, oftentimes that's where it will come out, is by talking about how he withheld, or in a case where you have an illness or a medical problem where he's either withheld medication, will not take you to doctor's appointments, and the conversation just gets rolling. Or he took and spent all the money on beer instead of paying for medication. And so the conversations will get rolling, and then the women start to recognize in a women's group about the tactics that they are experiencing. So the power and control is at the center of it. And now that we have the visual, that's really helpful. And then the violence is what holds it all together. And then each spoke of the wheel is a part of those tactics. And then underneath them is each specific tactic.
And it doesn't mean that you have to have all, you know, six or seven of these dimensions, right?
No, it doesn't mean that. But so oftentimes women will come in not even recognizing that they're experiencing it until they start talking out their experience. And then they later recognize that he was using male privilege, or like I said, economic abuse, or the coercion and threats. And then you start talking about what that looks like and what that looked like for them. But you can talk to any of the women in group and they will say, oh my goodness, that could have been the same guy because the tactics are the same.
Yes.
Yeah. And in my experience, I have to say that those behaviors were enhanced after my diagnosis. And that's probably one of the things that it was very hurtful in terms of, like, the using intimidation. I remember when I was diagnosed and I came home and I was crying because the doctor said I needed to have a hysterectomy, not only a hysterectomy, but now a mastectomy. And so the way that he took it is like laughing and saying, well, they're taking all your women parts away. You're no longer going to be a woman, blah, 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 blah. It's like those hurtful things, like, instead of, like, giving you that support that you need in the time that you're mourning the loss that you're going to have, it's adding to perhaps a loss that you know that is happening as well. And so that those intimidation tactics, when I went and got those expanders, Laura, I mean, you know how painful those are. I got the first feeling, the first time that I came out of the exam room, the first words that were from him was, they're not big enough. As if that was my worry. I'm like, for me, it's like, how dare you, like, think about that, you know, when my mind is trying to move on to trying to heal through this process, or even accept it, because it was within days of me, you know, being diagnosed of those things. Yeah, a lot of emotional abuse, a lot of intimidation, those things that were on the wheel. Also, I have to say that probably isolation, because of how he was including others to believe his lies, that they would think that, you know, I remember being in the stroke unit, for example, and he was telling the members of my church at that church at that time that I was being unfaithful. I was at my ex-husband's house, that my car was in his garage, and that he had busily saw my car in there. And it was very humiliating when the pastor came to the hospital and I had to click my car key so that he could see that my car was in the parking lot. And so I remember him saying that he needed more help than I did. And perhaps that's why he, like, embraced them. And so for embrace him. And so for me, it was kind of when you need it most of someone, it looks like doors were closing and you were wondering why. So a lot of that, I remember him using his kids as, I say, check, as tools. Yes, his kids as pawns for their exes to have some hatred against, you know. And so it was just really, really immature. And I want to say immature on his part of how he handled the whole situation. But I swear, it's like looking at this wheel, and when the judge gave me that, I mean, I just looked at it, but then afterwards analyzing it in detail and saying, this was my life with this person. And I'm glad I'm no longer in that relationship, because from the economic, from intimidation, from physical abuse, from sexual abuse. 2 days after my mastectomy, there was sexual abuse. And in my mind, it was like, how dare does someone who claims to love you hurt you in that manner when they put their needs before your health? And I was, you know, asking Cami in terms of sometimes women blame themselves. Sometimes you feel embarrassed or ashamed. And I know that I didn't want to share that with my family. I didn't want to share that with my mom, especially, or my parents. It wasn't until I disclosed it in an article with SBC that my brother was calling me and saying, like, you didn't share this with us. Like, are you okay? I'm okay. But I wanted to raise awareness because no one should feel the way that I felt. And no one should feel that they are alone with what is going on. Cancer is hard enough. Why do we have to go through an abuse that we can get out? And I say, I'm glad that I got rid of that cancer. And I remember when I finally got my divorce last August and coming out of that courtroom, I was crying like a baby. Why? Because I realized at that point in time that I had cancer and I had to deal with it. And so for me, it was like, I dealt with that. Now I have to deal with this.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And I want to unpack that a little bit. You know, you touched upon so many elements of, you know, a breast cancer diagnosis as well that sometimes we don't even realize happened to us because we get diagnosed with a cancer and it's a whirlwind of doctor's appointments, needing to make decisions really quickly in a short window of time that will have long-term effects, trying to figure out, you know, surgery options, mourning the loss of body parts, right? Going through surgery. And depending on the type of cancer that you have, in your case, Lord, is too, like, you know, having an opportunity to have a hysterectomy because that was the recommendation of the doctor as well. And so as you're mentally going through all of this, your sense of identity is called into question, right? Whether it's, you know, physical changes, the emotional changes, being thrown into medical menopause and all of these things that you're dealing with all at once. And then having this partner of yours at the time, you know, take advantage in so many aspects of that will that we were just discussing, you know, is quite alarming. And I would want to ask if you wouldn't mind sharing, because you haven't seen this will before. So what prompted you to seek help or support or to decide to go through with a divorce? Because so many times, you know, we can suffer in silence and just assume this is normal for us and not take action. So I would love to hear your process on that.
So I would say that, honestly, having gone to a stroke and being at the stroke unit and the doctor saying, this person is not healthy, I need to call the cops. And the cops came to my exam room and they said, we're going to process starting the order of protection. Because if you let him continue this way, you're going to die.
Wow. So the hospital recognized the threat.
And women are often not positioned in such a way that they can hold their abusive partner accountable. It has to be someone from within the system.
And I am so thankful they did that because having had the news of a cancer diagnosis, I was trying to deal with that. And I was, in a way, putting that in the back burner of those abuses, of those words. But little by little, those words were killing any love whatsoever for that individual, where the point where it's like, I didn't care anymore. It was just, and there was sometimes like, I know being in the exam room and going through the court in the hospital, in the stroke unit, and explaining to the judge why I needed an order of protection and having the police there with me, my lawyer there with me. And it's like, that's when I understood the seriousness of the situation, that I couldn't return home because if I did, for sure I was going to die because of another stroke or because of all of this stress. It's just compounded stress after so many experiences with that individual, from a loss of two pregnancies and the humiliation of you're not a woman because you can't carry kids or you can't conceive kids. So it was just very hurtful, the words that he would say.
Well, what we found with many of the women is that when they really launch into the tactics is once they feel like they have the woman. And what that means is they've bought a house together, she's pregnant, they've made some other major purchase or an illness. Once they sense that vulnerability or know that vulnerability, they really up the ante as far as using the power and control and violence. And at some point they actually even become more physically violent. And a woman at that point in time, that's when she really starts to disappear. And that's what when you talk to women, that's how they describe it. I'm disappearing. I am losing myself. I have to do things in a way that I cannot upset him. And when you're already experiencing a health crisis, that's just horrible.
Yeah. Or even having that person in your mind still, because during this process, you're still going through surgeries. I'm not done with surgeries. And hearing those words, and when you're looking at yourself in the mirror, and it's like, you're no longer a woman. You're no longer a woman because of, you know, this body parts that are no longer part of you. But I learned to say the body parts that the God-given parts that I no longer have because cancer took away does not make me any less of a woman. And so I just had to learn to remember that. Yeah.
But oftentimes women will say, he's still with me. And people will counter her and say, well, he's gone. He's not in the house. But they can look in the mirror, whether they're getting ready for court or to go to a doctor's appointment, and they can hear the things that he has said to them previously. It's like being conditioned or being trained, because he's there with those words, even if he isn't actually physically present. You can look in the mirror, you can be putting makeup on, and you'll hear him say horrible things about how she's putting her makeup on and why she's dressing that way. And as she walks out the door, she loses herself. Or even before she walks out the door, in that moment, in those moments, she's losing herself again, even if she had started to build on some sort of inner strength. He comes back.
And is that where some of your support services and these groups and resources really become a critical, like, lifeline for these women?
Yes, and they will tell you that it's needed to have someone to reach out to. And the thing is I work part-time for the Domestic Abuse Intervention Programs. And the thing is about that is the violence isn't just a 9-to-5 type of thing, or the women's trauma. It doesn't stop in just those 8 hours. So I've opened myself up to texting and phone calls and emails, because it doesn't just, like I said, I could say it 100 times, it doesn't end after 5 o'clock. And so I've had phone calls where women have gone into labor at 2 o'clock in the morning and just needed someone because their partner has disappeared on them, or they have no way to think themselves through the pregnancy or the what's going to happen next. Do I call an ambulance? So often they need to have somebody, and somebody who's local and a voice and a face that they recognize, because that being familiar with someone equates to safety.
Yeah. And stability. Survivingbreastcancer.org, that cancer doesn't take vacations, you know, and we host one of our, you know, weekly support groups on Thursday, and you know, for Thanksgiving we're like, and bring your turkey, we're not canceling, what's happening, like, yes. You know, rain, shine, everything, right? Like, mm-hmm. Cancer, just like you were mentioning, isn't a 9-to-5. and with us long after, even after going through active treatment, you know, you're looking in the mirror, you can see your scars, you can remember that, you know, everyone remembers the date they were diagnosed, like it's their birthday. Like we have these like moments that are like grained into our minds. So, so I appreciate that. And Cammie, if you are open to sharing your personal story as well, you started off in the intro saying that you were a domestic violence survivor yourself. I would love to give our audience your perspective and experience as well as a way of kind of highlighting some of these signs that we can be more attuned to.
Sure. So my partner, when I was in the relationship, everything began as feeling really familiar to me. And I often will talk to women now and I say, if it feels that familiar, run. Because what happened is the abuse escalated from there, from just feelings of what felt familiar from my past overall. And had I listened to myself, and so often women medically and in other ways, they don't listen. We're taught to just put things off for whatever reason. It's a socialization thing. I spent 10 years with him, but it actually ended up being longer because he traumatized me continually. Even after those 10 years, he was always either stalking or harassing me through the kids. There was no leaving him. Days in the courtroom, I was that woman who, before I even got to the courtroom, he was with me. And he was intimidating on every level possible by sending messages through the kids. The other problem that was really hard to cope with was the fact that he was a police officer. And so batterers often, or abusers, look for people who will align with them because it gives them a stronger foothold and being able to say, look, you're crazy. I have these people behind me to prove it. Well, he had far more credibility in the courtroom, with social services, just because he wore a badge. And it was terrifying to me. It was like there was no escaping. Unfortunately, he passed away about 5 years ago. He was drinking and driving, and he killed himself and another woman, which was actually a nurse who had been called into work. And she was about 2 minutes away from work. So his lifestyle and his choices were devastating for so many people who had ever come into contact with him. People asked me if I felt validated after he died. I can't say that I felt validated because I thought about all of the harm that he caused. My kids lost their father. Another family lost their mother. He was also a partner where when I had a twin pregnancy that he wouldn't validate the fact that I was having twins, and he would abuse me on the way to doctor's appointments if he chose to show up for the doctor's appointments. He berated me so badly on the way to the doctor's appointments that I was so traumatized that I wanted to jump out of the car. In fact, one time I actually reached for the handle of the car to jump out. And when I had related that later to other people, they thought, what were you thinking? You could have hurt your kids, your babies, you know. In my mind, all I wanted to do was just make him stop, make it stop, make the abuse stop. And like, if I think about it now, I can even think about how much I just want to plug my ears, because you can just go back there in your mind. So the damage that batterers cause, it's just limitless. But yes, there is hope beyond that. There is healing beyond that. And there is strength beyond that, and knowing that you're enough after all the things that they've said and all the ways that they've caused harm, there's hope. And it oftentimes comes through women supporting each other and having an understanding about their experience. And that's what makes sense to me, is women supporting women.
Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that, Cammie. I'm glad. You know, you can be a voice and resource for so many as well. So I appreciate you sharing that story. how do we kind of like turn things from these experiences, right? So we talked about identifying these elements and tactics that people will use and some of the resources, again, of, you know, support groups or hotlines or ways to reach out and get help. What are some of the things we should look for when we're in healthy relationships or when, you know, things are going well? What are like those positive signs that can be reinforced so we know that we're heading down that right path?
Well, it's the exact opposite of what's on the power and control wheel. So there is actually a wheel which is called the equality wheel. And what you look for in those kinds of relationships, instead of using coercion and threats, there'd be negotiation and fairness, which would be seeking mutually satisfying resolutions and conflict, being acceptant to change, and being willing to compromise. And equality would be at the center of that, and then nonviolence would be holding it all together. And then non-threatening behavior, I'm just going to kind of paraphrase some of this, talking and acting so that she feels safe and comfortable in expressing herself and doing things, respect, listening to her non-judgmentally, being emotionally affirming, which is so important when you're having a medical issue, affirming, understanding, and valuing her opinions. So he might even have a differing medical opinion on what you should do with your health, but he would still validate you in making your choices rather than degrade you. So trust and support, supporting her goals in life, respecting her right to own her feelings, friends, activities, and opinions, honesty and accountability, accepting responsibility for self, acknowledging past use of violence, admitting when they're wrong, communicating openly and truthfully, responsible parenting, sharing parental responsibilities, being positive and nonviolent role model for the children and not using the children, also a shared responsibility, mutually agreeing on fair distribution of work, making family decisions together, and then economic partnership, which is making money decisions together, making sure both partners benefit from financial arrangements. And one thing about men when they've used violence, sometimes it seems like things are getting better for whatever reason, and then they slide right back into using the tactics, and they'll say things like, so under honesty and accountability, they'll say if they are truly a changed person and they've done the work, they wouldn't tell you how much they had changed. Everybody else would see their change first. If they're telling you they've changed, they haven't changed. It takes time.
Everything that you have mentioned were everything he was not. And so it's hard because you want to, you know, you go into a marriage, of course, not thinking you're going to go into a divorce, but it is much necessary when it's affecting your own health and putting your life in danger. So for me, it's crucial to bring light to this topic because I want to make sure that women who are in this situation, realize one, that they're not alone, two, that there's help, and three, that they can get out. Same thing for men. Not only women are abused, but males too. So this goes for both. Yeah. But like you said, especially with a diagnosis of whatever illness it is, this impacts our health as well. Stress is a huge factor of things that are going to be just going downhill with all of our health. Yeah.
I appreciate you both sharing your stories. And Lourdes, you know, present day, how are you doing today?
Oh, night and day. This is my normal. This is my normal life. I have never experienced abuse in my life before this relationship. It was a really eye-opener of what I should never and will never accept in a relationship. And Cami, you mentioned something that there were warning signs to previous, I call them victims, that were showing all of those signs as well. I was the third. Someone is the fourth right now.
So I want to turn to each of you for, you know, final remarks or last comments. I feel like we covered a lot of heavy topics here, not just sharing personal stories, which I think are so incredible to have, like, to be able to share your lived experiences and let people know that, you know, this isn't just, you know, a peer reviewed journal or a paper or like things to just, you know, be aware of, but these are realities. And the more that we can talk about it and shine light on it and share it through our various platforms and our networks. And, you know, I think this is really important because as someone who leads a breast cancer organization that is primarily women, and we do have some men as well, but primarily women, this will get in front of them and also be able to share the signs early on. So hopefully they can seek support and get the resources that they need. So Cami, is there anything that we haven't touched upon that you would like to share? Or, you know, I know we have your website that we'll link to as well, and, you know, ways people can get in contact. But I want to give you an opportunity in case there's anything I did not ask that you would like to highlight.
Well, I just want to be really clear on the point that it's important to put the wheel into women's hands so that they can recognize the tactics. So often women come in to me and they've not even seen the wheel, and they've had other people describe their life to them and their experience, but it's much more powerful if they are able to describe their experience. They have a better understanding faster when they see the wheel and they look at the tactics. It makes sense to them. They're able to put it into words. And with trauma, that can be really, really hard to do. When you have a woman who is really upset, you know, it's hard for them to explain what they're experiencing. And then to see that it's not just put downs, that coercion and threats is a part of it, or using her children and what using her children looks like, and just helping her to shape in these words what that experience is.
Yeah, I think it's crucial that you understand, whoever's listening to this, is that there's nothing that you did, there's nothing that you said that makes this all right. A behavior of the partner abusing someone, it's not acceptable, should not be acceptable, and you should not be embarrassed to try to get out of that relationship or even share it or talk about it. I think it's just, you need to empower yourself, and sometimes it's easier said than done, but you need to understand that a healthy relationship is the total opposite of this power and control wheel. Because you deserve a healthy relationship. I know I do. And so because of that, I want to share that information with everyone who I can provide that information, because I don't want anyone to ever feel like they're alone or even feel that they can seek help. And so I just want to provide that information. And I also want to give thanks to Judy Brewer, who put me in contact with Cami, and I really appreciate the knowledge and the experience that you provide, honestly, and you also sharing your personal experience. I think it's amazing that, you know, we have that resources. And I was just doing research on, you know, domestic violence, and the power and control wheel came up, and just, they are the founders of this. What a wonderful resource to have.
Thank you both for sharing your stories, providing a wealth of information, and being a source of inspiration to our listeners. I really appreciate you guys spending the time to be on Breast Cancer Conversations. And thank you, everyone, for listening to our show. I would like to acknowledge that all of the information on our podcast are from personal experiences and are not a substitute for professional medical advice. You should always contact your medical care team. If you're looking for specific topics or would like to be a guest on our show, please feel free to reach out to me. My email is laura@survivingbreastcancer.org. Until next time, keep on thriving.